Hi, this is Amanda DeCadene, and I'm here to let you know that if you want to stay connected to me and the conversations I'm having, and most importantly, if you want to support this podcast, the best way for you to do it is to sign up for my Substack. That is where I share the more personal lessons I'm learning, extra wisdom from my guests, plus the tools I'm gathering from the various teachers in my life. The way you get access to all of this is by heading over to www.amandadecadene.substack.com and just sign up. Put your email in. It's totally free. So head over to www.amandadecadene.substack.com. Welcome back to another episode of The Conversation with me, Amanda DeCadene. Today, I'm joined by a woman whose work has deeply resonated with me. Her name is Dr. Martha Beck. Martha wrote a book that is, to date, one of my favorite books, talking about a subject matter that I am very fond of discussing. The book is called The Way of Integrity, Finding the Path to Your True Self. It's about how living in alignment with your integrity can lead you to your own truth, even though at times it can be obviously extremely uncomfortable and painful, but hey, at least you're living in the truth. Living in integrity is something that I talk about a lot because, you know, I want to live in integrity, but how do you do that when you're living in a world that doesn't value integrity as a quality? We discuss this and many other subjects in this interview. I hope you'll find it as interesting as I did listening to Martha. Martha Beck, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you for taking the time to chat with me. I really appreciate it.
It's an honor. Thank you for your amazing work.
Thank you. I try. I think we're all trying, right, to make a difference.
Yeah. And some of us are.
Yeah, some of us are, and some really aren't. And, you know,
I guess
we have to, you know, I mean, I'm not going to be judgmental about it.
Not out loud.
Definitely not on a podcast, but it's like separately we can sidebar about this. But finding your tribe is so crucial. And it takes a while, I think.
Yeah. There's this great poem by Stanley Kunitz. I think it starts with, "I have made for myself a tribe out of my true affections, and my tribe is scattered. How shall my heart be reconciled to its feast of losses?"
Oh, gosh. Yeah, the feast of losses. What does that mean to you when you hear that?
Oh, heavens. It means... It takes me to the time when I was 29, 30 years old, when I left my job, my profession, which was academia, my religion, which meant I left my family, every friend I'd ever made before the age of 17 when I left for college. I left Utah for college, so I left Mormonism, left my home. I left pretty much everything. Figured out I was gay, so there went my marriage. Like, literally, I used to say, burn every bridge but love. And it just fell out that way for me. It just happened to all concentrate at this one particular time. And that's when I remember reading that poem.
Do you think that those moments happen cyclically in a woman's life specifically? Because what I'm observing is that period of time where you suddenly wake up to, there's a series of events that occur and you wake up to the realization that the life that you're in no longer fits you, is something that seems almost cyclical for women. I mean, certainly for myself, I'm experiencing that.
Yeah, I compare it to metamorphosis of a caterpillar into a butterfly, which only happens once. And it happens in a way that most people don't know. The caterpillar builds a chrysalis and then it melts completely into a soup. So it's the only place in nature where a living organism has no organization. It's just a puddle of liquid. And when it's completely dissolved, it triggers a reaction that makes those same cells reconstruct into a butterfly. I think it happens to women, maybe to men as well, over and over and over. Like, we become different creatures many times in one lifetime, which is kind of horrifying and kind of amazing.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's horrifying and it's amazing. And getting used to loss and what I would say is catastrophic change is something that we're just not taught how to do.
Right, right. A lot of traditional cultures actually have ceremonies for this. They'll take young men at puberty and they take them into the wilderness, obscure their faces with dirt, burn everything they've ever owned, and basically take away their identity and then allow them to find themselves again under the guidance of elders. The women are sent into isolation. So men have to learn to bond. Women have to learn to be alone, to individuate. So the girl is stuck in a cave or an underground hut or something while she figures out who she is. And that's supposed to be an object lesson in what to do when it all falls apart. And we really don't have that in the sort of post-Enlightenment Western diaspora
paradigm.
Yeah. It's really not there.
It's, well, there's so many traditions that come from Eastern practices, or at least not Western practices.
Right, right.
That are incredible. I mean, what you've just mentioned, if we had have had those tools in Western culture, it wouldn't come as such a shock because,
right,
you know, inevitably, as you go from girlhood to womanhood, that is a transition.
Yep.
And then, you know, for me, at least, I was a mom at 19. And so that was a transition. And then getting sober at 22 was a transition.
Mm.
And then, you know, going into perimenopause, another transition that feels very similar to the one that I had as a teenager, yet mm-hmm. I'm an adult. And we have no rituals to mark these moments.
Yeah. I mean, our model of growth is linear. You're unformed and idiotic, and you get smarter and more suave as you grow. And it's
apparently
supposed to be a straight line up that golden pyramid, right? But in other cultures, they'll see it as cyclical. There's a winter for every summer, right? It goes around and around. I like to combine those into a spiral shape. So you go around this process of metamorphosis many times in your life, but each time you go around it, you're better at the process of metamorphosis itself. So it doesn't have to be as difficult, as shocking, as really, really traumatic as it can be.
Well, it's jarring. And
I like
how you're reframing this as cyclical and, you know, that we are revisiting the same but different at different stages. That would feel that immediately when you said that, I was like, I exhaled a little. Mm-hmm. I really think that reframing is important. Okay, so there's so much to talk to you about. I mean, there's just so much. I mean, I've been familiar with your work for so long. The
right.
fact that you have had such a long career with creating work that is impactful for so many people. I just want to acknowledge that and say thank you.
Thank you for reading it.
Yeah, and I love
that means everything.
And I love that so many generations, you know, connect with your work. The last book of yours that I read was The Way of Integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the word integrity. I love what integrity means. And I was curious what inspired you to write about such a powerful subject.
Well, as I said, I was raised in a very, very intensely religious community where my father was the foremost apologist of Mormonism when he was living. And that means that he provided evidence showing that the doctrines of the church were correct, you know. And to do that, he had to lie a lot. And I didn't know that growing up. I just knew that everything bobbed and sank. I didn't know what truth was. And after I'd gone through a few metamorphoses of my own, the division in my own psyche between what felt true at the deepest level to me and the various ways I'd been living, it became so painful that I couldn't go on anymore. And there's a lot of evidence to show that living with secrets and lies is actually physically hard on us. Our brains don't like it. Our bodies hate it. I got very ill. I got very depressed. I got very anxious. And then I finally just thought, I have to find out the truth. And went on a truth-finding expedition that took away all those things I just mentioned to you, family, friends, home, job, marriage, everything, and set me free.
What did that journey look like? I mean, it's hard to paraphrase it, obviously, because we don't have all day, but I'm sure it was extensive.
What happened was I had a surgery. I got so sick that I ended up needing an emergency surgery. And during that surgery, I had something like one of those near-death experiences you hear about.
Oh, wow.
I wasn't near death, but this light appeared. I was conscious. I was looking around the room. I was sitting up, lying down, even though my body was on the surgery table. And then I saw this light up between the surgical lights, and it was incredibly bright and indescribably beautiful. There's no way to tell anyone how beautiful it looked. The words ball of light are so absurd compared to what it looked like. But when it started to grow, and then it touched me, and I felt this incredible warmth and love, and I felt like I remembered what I was.
Oh, yes, gosh.
And the bliss and joy and peace I felt were absolutely indescribable. And then it said, look, you're about to go through some really hard things, but just remember, I'm always here. This is always here for you. This is what you are. And your job is not to go out and live a hard life and then die and go to heaven and feel this way. You are meant to feel this way in your life, in this body. And I came out of that surgery and just started chopping away at anything that didn't feel like that light. If it felt like a light, it had to go. And I remember after my whole life burned down and I was sitting in a house in Phoenix where my then husband and my kids and I had fled to get away from Utah, and sitting in a house that had completely white walls and everything was just white, and I didn't want to put anything in it. It was like being surrounded by that light. And I just wanted to sit in the clarity and simplicity and just based in it. It just healed me like tangibly day after day after day. I started meditating. I started doing other spiritual practices because now I was out of my religion, but that light gave me a faith that there was something. And that's really, it was this incredible escape into what felt like this brilliant, beautiful light.
Have you been able to maintain that connection?
Yeah, that's actually my entire job in life. That's all I've ever set out to do with my career, with my personal life, with anything, is does it take me closer to that feeling? Yes. Okay, I will do that. And I'll do it unquestionably and unquestioningly all day, every day. And at this point, I'd say, I told you when we got on, I was having a disturbingly good day because I feel so happy so much of the time that I just think there's got to be a catch.
Well, that's incredible that you had that experience and it stayed with you, because frequently when people are fortunate enough to have that kind of experience, it can dissipate, or they don't maintain it, or whatever the various reasons are.
Oh, it's horrifying. Because I got obsessed with near-death experiences after that. And what you read between the lines is that most people go into a pretty profound depression after having one of those bliss experiences, because you want it back so much. And it was not something that just stayed with me. It was something that I would lose, and then I'd say, where'd it go? It's just like the game, you're getting warmer, you're getting colder. And I just am willing to do pretty much anything that feels warmer.
And, so you reorientate yourself towards that feeling, and I would assume that that feeling really keeps you in integrity.
That is the feeling of integrity, this absolute pure joy.
Oh, I want to feel that.
One thing I really believe is that the reason we want it so much is that it exists somewhere in us. Like if you said to me, I don't know what to do with my life, and I said, okay, go be a plumber, and you said, I don't want to be a plumber, that would mean that at some level you do know what you're meant to do with your life.
It's reverse psychology.
Yeah, and the point is that the only way we know to yearn for something is that we feel it some way. If we literally have no experience of it, we can't yearn for it. But we yearn for peace, we yearn for liberation, love, belonging, because somewhere in us, that's what we're made of. And we coat it with layers, usually of socialization, sometimes traumatic experience, and it blinds us to what we are, but we never stop longing to go back to it.
Right, because that is our original being.
Yeah.
The purest sense of self.
Yeah. Yeah, my son has Down syndrome. One of the things that catalyzed the change was that I was getting my doctorate at Harvard, and I had my second pregnancy 6 months in. I found out the baby had Down syndrome, and I had a very, very quick decision to make, and I chose not to terminate the pregnancy. And I'm very pro-choice, do not get me wrong. But I also, around him, always had more of that feeling. And one day when he was 23, we were coming back from his best friend's mother's funeral, which was awful. She was young. And I said, it's okay to cry if you want. And he said, no, I don't need to cry so much. It's easier after the light comes and opens your heart. And I said, what? A light came and opened your heart? He said, yes, in my bedroom. And I said, when was that? He said, May 10th. And this was like in February. And I said, well, that's amazing. And I've seen it too. And then I said, you know, it told me no matter, even though we can't see it, it's always there with us. And Adam said, oh, I can see it. And I said, you mean what, now? And he was like, yeah. And I said, well, where is it? Is it up there? Is it down here? Is it in your heart? And he just looked at me like I was crazy and said, it's everywhere. And it really is everywhere. And when you drop, it's like in the Chinese Tao Te Ching, it says, in the pursuit of knowledge, every day something is added. In the pursuit of the way, the Tao, every day something is dropped. And it's when you drop the things from your life that aren't working that the light inside you starts to connect with the light all around you. And the feeling is just exquisite. Yeah.
So many people work really hard to connect with that feeling and aren't able to. Why do you think that is?
I think it's because we have an entire culture that is devoted to getting us to think along very specific lines. As I said, a lot of traditional cultures had things where they would sort of blow people's minds to get them to give up their illusions. That's certainly Asian culture did that with all the meditation traditions. But shamanic cultures all over the world did it. And we don't have that. We have a culture where we're supposed to grip very tightly to certain ways of thinking and hang on to that and use them to get things. It dominantly favors the left hemisphere of the brain, which learns very systematically and evaluates and judges things, and also has this quality of not knowing that anything but its own way of thinking exists. And so it gets us in these little tight knots of anxiety, but we don't know there's anywhere else to go. I'm just writing a book about this right now. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, because after I wrote The Way of Integrity, people said, I'm doing my best to be honest, but I'm still so afraid. And I was like, oh, yeah. That's the thing. To me, it's really obvious that anything I'm afraid of is a lie. If you look deeply at anything that is frightening, I'm going to die. Can I be absolutely certain that's true? Meditate on that for a few thousand hours. And you end up thinking, what am I? There's not an atom in my body right now that was present 7 years ago. Every atom in your body refurbishes every 7 years. This is not the same body that had those children. So what did? What am I? I'm a wisp of consciousness that for some reason allows molecules to cohere around it in a predictable way. But that wisp of consciousness is not physical. So am I going to die?
That's such an interesting question. I mean, for anyone that has been present when somebody dies, you can undeniably feel that energy dissipate and move into the ether. I've been there and felt it. And for me, it was like a breeze almost
that
kind of rushed past me and went up. And I sort of felt like it had, you know, if it had been any stronger, my hair would have blown out my face. Do you know what I mean? It was like,
amazing.
I feel like, okay, this is my life force is in this suit, in this body, you know, but, you know, quite where it goes, we don't know. Although there are people who have had those near-death experiences that will have more of an opinion about where we go.
Based on my own experience, I'm very excited about it. And if we just go out like candles, who cares? Like, who's going to be around to worry?
Either way, we're okay.
Yeah. And if you sit and look incredibly deeply at any fear you have, it ultimately dissolves like tissue paper in the rain. But our culture is a culture of intense materialism, intense ambition, incredible focus on material wealth, and high anxiety. And I really believe a lot of us have been socialized into a very anxious brain state that's hard to get out because we're surrounded by it.
Yeah, I mean, you're describing capitalism ultimately.
Oh, yes, it's all part of it.
It's interesting because when I first read your book was the Way of Integrity was right after my dad had died, which was just over a year ago. And that cracked me open in a way that I had not been cracked open since I was a teenager and made me reevaluate everything.
Wow.
What am I doing? What's my purpose? Who do I care about? You know, every single thing, right? I'm still not fully calibrated into a new shape. I'm still in process here. But what I found really interesting was this concept of living truthfully, because I'm in recovery, you know, a very long time as well. And to thine own self be true is, you know, at the center of my recovery work. And living in integrity for me has had really huge costs personally, professionally, because not everyone wants to be around someone who's living in integrity because... And I've often wondered, like, okay, how does this work? I feel like I'm living life with a set of playing cards. As I choose to live in integrity and choose to live my life with certain beliefs and principles, I feel like I'm going through life playing with a set of playing cards that not everyone else is playing with. So I'm trying to play with my cards and they're like playing a different game.
How do you live with those circumstances?
Because everyone else is using a different set of cards here. And maybe they're not living in integrity and they are living with less consciousness and they're fine with the lies. How do you navigate that?
It's so interesting because the more honest you get with yourself, the more you have sort of spider senses about it. And you start to notice if you're lying. I've talked to psychopaths, like murderers who were in prison. They don't understand that some people are telling the truth. And they have an objective. You know, everybody has objectives. And people are playing the same game sometimes of manipulation, of getting to the top, using each other, exploiting people, whatever. But there are also people who are playing the game of honesty. And when you're playing the game of honesty and you're really true to yourself, they might as well have a huge red sign on their faces that says, I lie for a living. It becomes so obvious. And then it's like, okay, I'm going to go over to someone else for a while. Sometimes you'll interact with those systems because it's necessary, but you do it very carefully with your eyes wide open and you see the writing on the wall before it gets dangerous. My motto in life is cave early. Like the second you see slippage where somebody's stories don't quite mesh with reality, I don't go there. You know, I get out with whatever I can take with me. And as I said, I left everything, including my profession, the way I made money. And I've jumped off a series of cliffs in my life. And as long as I'm playing the deck and playing the game of I'm going to be as true to myself as I possibly can and try to live in complete honesty, I always find other people who are willing to play with me. And I always have a sense of being supported and guided, you know, by my weird mystical whatever that is.
And how has it affected your career? Do you think your career would look different if you chose to not live in integrity?
Completely. Well, I'd be an academic for one thing. I used to write a monthly column for Real Simple magazine. And I'd been doing that for a couple of years right when they started. And they wrote up this contract for me that was like a writer's dream come true. It was an incredible amount of money. I mean, they gave me everything. And I was so excited. I was about to sign it. And that was on a Friday. And on Friday afternoon, Amy Gross, the editor at Oh, the Oprah magazine, which was also just starting out, she called me and she said, would you write an audition piece for us? And I said, well, I have this other contract, but let me go check it out. So I went, I'd never read a copy of the magazine. I got this Oprah magazine, and it had a 30-page article by Elie Wiesel about the nature of evil. And I was like, I'm in. And they couldn't pay me anything like the other contract. And there were no extra perks. And when I turned down the Real Simple People, the editor said, I can't imagine you got a better offer. And I was like, from one perspective, I did not. But I know what feels warmer, and I have to do it. That's just how I do. Less money, more joy, more truth. I'll always take that.
You've probably heard about probiotics and the importance of a healthy gut microbiome. Well, I've got some news for you. Over 15 years of research on the vaginal microbiome have revealed that our gut isn't the only part of our body that thrives on an optimal microbiome. For years, Seed has been my go-to for improving my family's gut health, so I'm excited that Seed has launched VSO1 Vaginal Symbiotic. Your period, exercise, diet, sex, this can all mess with your vaginal microbiome, making it sensitive to imbalances and unwanted, uncomfortable issues. And I don't need to tell you that there's nothing worse than feeling like something is off with your vagina. That's why I'm so into Seed's VSO1. It's the first vaginal probiotic suppository designed to nourish your vagina with the essential biome it needs to flourish. I've read the research and I've interviewed the scientists behind VSO1, and I've decided to give my vagina the attention she deserves. If you want to check it out, please go to seed.com/AmandaC and use 25 Amanda C for 25% off your first month supply of Seed.
I relate to that. I really do.
Mm-hmm. I also have had to make peace with the fact that what I do is not going to be mass appeal because I don't want to dilute and lose integrity with what I'm putting out in the world.
Well, when you think about it, I was trained as a sociologist, right? So what I see is a system that discards people who live in integrity. It discards most people, actually. It discards everyone but the highly privileged and the, you know, basically the people at the top of the cis white males, white supremacist, the whole thing. But that system cannot sustain itself indefinitely. It's not that it's broken. It's working exactly as it was meant to do. It's to keep people of power in power over other people. It's doing its job beautifully, but it's also destroying the world, you know? And there are people at the margins now saying, you know what? We now have the technology to communicate with billions of people. Once it was only governments that could do that. Now you can do it from your office free.
Yeah.
And a lot of people feel something stirring inside them that says the way we have been living on the earth is not integrity. It is not love. And we don't want to live without love and truth. There's a consciousness that's rising. And I remember writing about this 20 years ago and my editor just saying, you're crazy. There are no people like this. And I said, I'm writing to these people. And you know, that the stuff I wrote was like a message in a bottle thrown out into the world. I just hoped somebody would find it. So when you say, you know, you've had a successful career, whatever, it's all been messages in bottles. I never thought anyone would find it. But look how many people did. You did. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Are you surprised at how many people have connected with your work and continue to?
Gobsmacked, shocked, horrified in some ways. I'm always like, oh my goodness, if I'd known, I would have tried harder.
Yeah. Right? It gives me hope, actually. It gives me hope. When I read something that's as powerful as the work that you do, I think, oh, thank God people are reading this.
I want to couch this very carefully. There's something about the mechanics of terrorism where there's no specific leader. There are pockets of people who share ideals. And what happens is they can share information and nothing can stop it because there's no head to cut off. And that, as there is horrible darkness in that, there is a bright side. There are pockets of light and individuals who are highly idealistic, reaching out to each other, learning each other's work, feeling each other's presence. And there's a hum that goes with that. So even as we look at the headlines about the evil spreading around the world and the horrors of everything, I believe in an at least equal and opposite force that's rising at the same time and will be just as unstoppable.
You know, when I hear you say that, that resonates with me as true. And it is what I fall back on to reassure myself frequently. Mm-hmm. I also feel that it's so important to elevate those voices.
And look at what you're doing. Like, look at what you've done.
Yeah, thank you.
Wow.
And what I've tried to do is to sandwich voices that are less known in between voices that are very known, to use those known voices to elevate the voice in between.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
From my perspective, one of the best things about fame is to be able to shine the light on people who don't have the light on them, but yeah, really they should have the light on them.
I think that's probably the only good use of fame.
Yeah,
fame.
And being able to eat the restaurants you want to eat at.
True.
That's
true.
Another one.
For me, an extreme introvert, I like the ability to reach through the various modes of communication we have now and feel each other connecting.
Yeah, and it's also the work and what you're bringing forward that's resonating with so many people. It's kind of coming through you. You're the vessel for it.
Thank you. I think we all are. You know, I still meditate. And for those of us who do, when the left brain finally goes quiet, what happens? This happened to my friend Jill Volte Taylor when she had a massive left hemisphere stroke. She was a Harvard neuroanatomist. And what she saw as an observable reality then was that she was a cloud of energy that had no differentiation from the rest of the universe. She felt at the size of the universe and everything was part of it. She was actually in the shower when she was having the stroke, and she would put her hand on the tiles and she would see a hand in the tiles, and then her left hemisphere was pulsing. So it would pulse off, and there was no separation between hand and tile. They were the same entity. They were all just energy that was reacting to other energy, which is one way of describing the universe in terms of physics as well. So when you tap into that, and if it happens in meditation, it's very disorienting at first, and then it's kind of amazing. And then you walk around and start to see that everyone is a conduit of it. Everyone's a conduit of the light. The yeah. light is everywhere.
Yeah, I do believe that. You know, for me, sometimes just going and sitting without my phone in nature.
Yeah.
And really allowing the energy of the squirrels and the sun and the trees and the birds and the bugs and the bees and the grass yeah. to like really feel that.
Yeah.
That I can at times experience a tiny bit of that feeling.
Even people who have a picture of a natural scene like a tree in a hospital room after heart surgery will heal faster than people who have modern art or whatever.
I have read that.
And after 3 hours in a forest, your cancer-killing cells like triple and stay elevated for a month. One of the pieces of violence our culture, our incredibly violent culture, has imposed on us is this weird idea that we're different from nature. Mm. Like even the fact that we say we're going into nature. Hello, what are we?
We are
nature.
You know?
And remembering that is a step toward integrity. And integrity, I just want to say this for people who don't know how I'm using it. It's not a Sunday school word. It literally means intact. It means to be one thing, whole and undivided, like an airplane where all the parts are working together so it can fly. And if you take out a bunch of the parts or misalign them, it can't fly. And that's not a moral judgment. It's just physics.
Yeah, I went to Japan over the summer and I learned about forest bathing.
Yes, love it.
Oh my gosh. That there is a culture which exists that includes readily available for anybody the opportunity to go into a forest. They have 6 dedicated forest bathing sites in Japan. Mm. You go in, they have therapists, they have doctors, they take your blood pressure, they see where you're at, your baseline, and they give you some tools and some skills to go into the forest and connect with nature and yourself. That, to me, was profound.
Yeah.
Profound. Yeah. And it made me so sad that our Western culture is so divorced from something so simple that could help, you know, entire cities to feel more grounded and connected.
Yeah. I mean, I was saying I've been through many metamorphoses and I cave early. One of the weirdest ones was that in my late 40s, I started waking up on a ranch in California, and I'd never been to this ranch. I knew it when I opened my eyes, it would be out there and I could see it. I wasn't asleep. I would wake up and I'd be in Arizona and I couldn't make sense of it. Finally, I would, in my mind, walk around this place until I knew it so well that I went on Zillow. I found exactly this property, and it cost exactly all the money I had. So on my 50th birthday, I spent all the money I had. Okay, this is not a good retirement plan. To go out and live. So we had 2,700 acres of national forest. And I went out there and I didn't know what I was doing. I just lived. Many days I didn't see anyone. I would be out tracking animals in the forest all day. And I didn't know why. I was terrified. Like, what am I doing? And it was so wonderful. I mean, I can't even begin to describe
how
that shifted me.
Wow. Okay. Let's talk about this for a minute.
Yay.
Okay. So that level of intuition, can we call it that?
Yeah.
So that level of intuition that you're willing to listen to and take action around, how did you refine listening to your intuition to the point where when you would have these dreams, specifically around this ranch house, you knew, oh, this is adding up. It's the exact amount that I have. You connected enough dots. But I'm assuming that someone who isn't so connected to their intuition, they may need to connect 30 dots to even think about it. But you probably had a handful before you knew, I got to go.
I had a lot, because the more you're listening for it, the more you get. But I had spent, so that was when I was 50, so I'd spent about 20 years where my obsession was not only doing this with myself, but helping other people read the compasses inside them. And the biggest ally I had is a very weak and frail body. So by the time I had that white light experience, I had been bedridden for about 12 years. I sort of could get up and move around. But most of the time I was just in bed shaking with pain. That's sort of how I raised my children and stuff. I never got out of bed. I still write lying down. I do most things lying down. But I noticed, and I was diagnosed with all these progressive, incurable autoimmune diseases, which don't give me any trouble as long as I live according to that sort of guidance. So my body suffers really dramatically when I turn away from what is right for me.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a very convincing kind of coach to have. Suffering has been my best ally. And I would rather do almost anything than suffer. I'm a coward. So I'll spend all my money on a ranch and live in the woods.
Yeah, but how did you get such a great relationship with your intuition outside of your body telling you? Because listen, people's bodies are telling them every single day what's going on, and they just self-medicate and check out and act out some more so they don't have to listen to it. Because the outcome is probably some change, and that's scary, and people, you know, we know why, right? So how did you get to the point where your relationship with your intuition was so connected?
Well, I said a little while ago, it's like the game, you're getting warmer, you're getting colder. Have you ever played that?
Yeah.
You hide an object. And then I used to play that with groups of people in seminars, and I'd hide it in a really difficult place, like put a pen inside a Kleenex box or something. And people would come in, and the group was only allowed to say, you're getting warmer, you're getting colder. It was a children's game. The person would come in, they would look, the other people were dying to tell them. And at some point, they almost always just stopped and said, where is it? And I'm like, that's not the way this works. If you can hang in there and go toward warmer and go away from colder every time, you will find the thing. You have to actually take 1,000 tiny steps in the direction of your joy before you get the instructions that will cause you to have to make changes. So make the little decisions. I just gave a speech to the National Association of Women Business Owners, and a woman came on to introduce me in very painful shoes. She sort of limped over to the podium and she said, I'm sorry, I don't usually walk like this, but look how my shoes are fabulous. They looked amazing. And then I gave my speech and she came back to get me off the stage and she was wearing tennis shoes.
Love it.
She said, you have to be willing to change your uncomfortable shoes before you have the courage to run off into the woods. It's an everyday, incremental, little tiny bit by tiny bit process.
Yeah, I feel like I'm following the threads of connection and becoming more attuned to those. And like you said, when you become more attuned to them, they're kind of everywhere.
Yeah, and it's so simple. It's like going to the eye doctor. Is option A or option B? So if I said to you, okay, later today, I assume you'll have an evening meal. Chicken or, you know, vegan cuisine. Feel in your body and your heart which one has the most yay to it.
But some people don't know. You could ask some people, and I've been in relationships with many of these types of people where they don't know how they feel.
You could literally put a gun to their head and say, how do you feel about it? I don't know.
It's because they've lost all kinds of perception, neuroception, introception, all knowing the inside of the body, knowing what the body's senses are saying and knowing what's going on around them. They lose it all. Our entire culture runs on fear. And I mean, Jeff Bezos said every Amazon employee should wake up terrified every single day so that they do a good job. What, thousands of people waking up terrified so that one of the richest men in the world can get richer? That makes no sense to me, but to everybody in the culture is like, oh yeah, he's right. That's a solid point. No, it isn't.
But, so how do we present alternatives to people that are workable within the capitalistic culture that we live in? There may be people who listen to this and go, yeah, I would love to trust my intuition that's saying to me, you know, I need to change that job or leave that marriage. But then how do I support myself? A lot of it's down to how do I financially support myself? Yeah. That's the kind of bottom line.
And it's an interesting thing. I mean, when I cast off from everything, I had no money and I was chronically ill and I had quit my profession. I thought I wanted to write, but that is a very slow way to make a lot of little tiny bits of money.
Yeah.
So, and I had three kids. And I was terrified. And then I thought, okay, well, I feel my intuition says I'll be a writer. So I'm going to focus on that. And then I got turned down by every agent in the agent book before the internet. And then I got this weird hankering to go apply for part-time work at a business school in Phoenix. And I thought, this is such a step back. It was an international business school. And I loved teaching there. And I was so confused. I was like, I know this was the right way, but leave academia. Well, now I'm back in academia. This makes no sense. But this whole philosophy of follow what feels right sort of came through in my teaching. And the students at Thunderbird Business School started paying me outside of being a professor to just work with them one-on-one, help them develop careers. And we answered that question a million times. How can I make money doing X, Y, and Z? We found so many ways that people could create a sort of financial ecosystem and follow their hearts. And after a few years, I quit there and started working as a life coach, even though the term makes me cringe, because it was so joyful. If I hadn't gone through that school again, I wouldn't have found it. That wasn't something there was no such thing as a life coach. I'd never heard of that.
Yeah. You're part of the OG people who started doing that, helping support people in their lives that weren't like trained psychotherapists.
Yeah. This is not why I got a PhD from Harvard. I have to be a life coach. But all I was doing was sort of teaching them how to go toward that light. What happens then in the majority of cases, and there I've seen hundreds and hundreds of people do this, you create an ecosystem out of your financial life. And often it will take you into odd corners and things that don't seem to be going in the right direction. It'll zig and it'll zag, but you just keep getting warmer, getting warmer, getting warmer. And when you really need money, the money finds a way to get to you. I got a boost from teaching and then I started getting income other ways. And I've watched this happen. One of my good, good friends is Elizabeth Gilbert. And I was sitting in a crowd where she was talking about Eat, Pray, Love. And two women were talking, and one woman said, that must be so nice. I'd have to sell my house and leave my husband if I wanted to just go on a tour around the world. And the other woman said, actually, that's exactly what she did. And she said, well, she had the money to do it. I'm here to tell you, Liz was living on nothing. While they were publishing Eat, Pray, Love, she moved to Cambodia and Vietnam and Laos because it was cheap enough for her to live there.
Yeah.
She didn't have money. And then it came in a wave after she just did this. She had this one bright thread in her depression was, I want to learn Italian. And the rest is history. Extreme example, but I've seen it happen in different ways for hundreds of people.
I love her work. I actually really want to interview her. She's a thread. It makes sense that you're bringing her up. But I have been feeling in my quest to follow the thread that I need to consistently share creative ideas. Hmm. And I do that with this podcast, but I have more ideas I want to share. I'm writing on a Substack, which I'm so late to the party. I'm feeling it and I'm doing it. Many people have said to me, oh, you know, you should look at what Liz Gilbert does. And she is a thread that has come back around and around. And I've gone, okay, I think I just have to interview her at this point because this is the thread that's coming through.
She's amazing. She is the real deal. She does not lie when she puts herself out to the world. She lives in a really wild life of extremes and has always tried to stay in integrity.
It makes sense that you're friends.
Yeah, does to me too. I used to dream about her and I'd think, oh, that's interesting. What does she symbolize? And I would try to analyze the dream and it all would always just be, no, just feels like Liz Gilbert.
Yeah. Do you still have prophetic dreams?
I think we all do. I use a particular method. I borrowed from Jung and created my own method of analysis. And I really do think that dreams and impulses, little flashes of insight will come. And I just think they're the right hemisphere of the brain going, okay, I'm pulling things from other parts of the world and flashing them into our heads. And again, if you live by you're getting warmer, you're getting warmer, you're getting warmer, I call them 1 degree turns. If you're flying a plane and you go 1 degree north every half hour, you won't even notice the plane moving, but you'll end up in a very different place, right? And when that happens, the brain is much more active and impressionistic and vivid than our culture allows it to be. And NASA did a study in the 1960s to identify creative geniuses. So George Land did this test, and it turned out 98% of five-year-olds tested as creative geniuses. He followed that cohort of people, and when they were grown up, only 2% of them did. So it's definitely being socialized out of us. And when we get back to it, the stuff we call weird and woo-woo is just normal.
Normal. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I've had prophetic dreams.
Really?
Similar to yours. And one of them was actually someone who had overdosed. And I was in a different country and I dreamt exactly what had happened and the drugs that they had taken, where they were laying on their body and who they were with. And
oh my God.
It was so strong. I actually called the paramedics from the US to go to the UK where the person was. And they went, and it was exactly as I had said.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. I haven't had one of those quite as clear, but I've definitely had kind of downloads, you know?
And the more you steer toward what is joyful for you, that's the thing. It's not like you have to do some hard, stringent discipline, and then you will be rewarded with insight. Go toward what brings you joy, and you will start to be guided. There it is. I just gave you a full course of life coaching. Go toward what brings you joy and you will be guided.
I have a little process that I do on my Substack and it's called Little Joys.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Every day I try to make space for like, where's the little joys, you know?
You know what I've noticed is that there are things that make me go, and it'll come in the middle of a normal breath, but I'll see something and suddenly something else breathes me. And it always comes with this lilt of joy. And I've had it more and more and more. And focusing on those things, even in little ways, I will tell your listeners right now, your fears about sustaining your life financially in the world are based on a corrupt and horrifying culture that has exploited people and destroyed and raped and plundered, and you don't want to be part of that. If you start following these little joys, there will be an ecosystem that grows up around you to sustain you financially. And I'm not sure what the model will be when capitalism reaches its logical endpoint, but I think it'll be much more like a forest than like a city.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. You said that you're writing a new book. Can you tell me a little bit about this?
I'm having such fun. I was like, why is everybody so scared all the time? Anxiety is just skyrocketing. And as I said, for me, when I'm afraid, I sit and look at it and it always falls apart and leaves me in a place of peace or joy. But clearly something was getting people stuck. And it turns out that in our brain, we have a little thing called the negativity bias. If I gave you a box of puppies with a cobra in it, you would not pay attention to the puppies. You'd pay attention to the cobra first, right? Because that helps you survive. However, if you go along in life and you only ever see cobras and never see the joys around you, you start to be more and more and more afraid. You live in a world full of snakes. Mm. The structure of the brain that puts out a pulse of fear then activates our left hemisphere and it says, I've got to control everything and then make a story, a verbal story about why I have to control and I have to be afraid. And it has to do with survival and money and on the other side of the brain is exactly the same set of structures with a totally different function. If an impulse comes in to the right side of the brain, its impulse is curiosity. So whatever makes you afraid will also make you curious. That's why we rubberneck at accidents. If you follow curiosity instead of fear, you go to connection. You start to be curious and connect things that you've known. You start to explore. The right side of the brain starts to connect things that you don't even know are connecting. It starts to solve problems in ways that you can't logically solve them. It starts to become inspired. And it takes you on this voyage of creativity. Those are mirror opposites in the brain, and they toggle. If you're in anxiety, tons of research says you can't be creative. Well, what I'm saying is when you're creative, and I've found this research bears me out, you can't be anxious. Mm-hmm. You have to push against the negativity bias and choose curiosity and connection.
How do you do that?
Well, for example, you meet a person who looks very different from you, different skin color, different clothing. Whoa. The left side of the brain would say, different, afraid, must protect myself. That's weird. And then you create a story about how they're bad and different. Look at that same person and have a pulse of fear, but then say, stop. There's a study that shows that if people just ask themselves, I wonder what that person feels like when they're eating dinner. Suddenly, the extreme biases against the strangeness go away and take you into a feeling of connection. I bet they feel much like I do. How is it different? You might then want to talk to that person. If you need a little courage to indulge that curiosity, but if you go toward learning about them, if they are dangerous, you'll figure it out. If they're not dangerous, you've got a new friend, right? So if there are all these little places where you're frightened to do something that also gives you a ping of desire, choose desire. Go toward the desire.
Okay. How do you differentiate between fear and intuition?
Mm-hmm. You can tell the difference because healthy fear has certain characteristics. It's always about something that's happening in the moment. There's something you can react to in the moment. It is a strong impetus to action. And as soon as you act, the fear goes down. So I've watched all kinds of animals being hunted. I like to go to Africa and do seminars there. I once saw a wildebeest come up to a pride of lions and just go, oh, and the lions looked at it like, seriously? And one lion got up and he's like, now I have to kill you. So he starts after the wildebeest. It runs. He just gave up. He's like, I'm too tired for this. Immediately, the wildebeest started grazing again inside of the lion. That's real fear. Read Gavin De Becker's The Gift of Fear. That's how a healthy fear works that way. Anxiety is more like being haunted. You're always afraid about things that aren't in the room. You're afraid of your taxes. You're afraid of death. You're afraid of somebody not loving you. if your dog's there in the room and the dog's not afraid, whatever you're afraid of isn't really there. So what do you do with all that mental energy that spins into anxiety? If you don't put it into creativity, it's going to go to anxiety. Those are the two options you have. The opposite of anxious is not calm, it's creative. And when you go to creative, you start to tap into the parts of yourself that are connected to creation. You open the apertures for that light to come through. And we are simply taught to do the worst possible set of behaviors that take us deeply into fear, don't let us get out of it, make us hate and exploit and kill each other. And we're not taught the opposite. We're taught not to be creative geniuses, even though we're born that way.
Yeah, I do agree with you. I also, you know, you use the example of the other, of seeing somebody who represents a different type of person in some way to you. Mm-hmm. And you have a feeling of differentiating between fear and curiosity. They do feel very similar. I'm still not clear intuition feels different than fear.
Okay, well, this is exciting. What you do is you gather the data yourself, because I believe in data and science. The math has to work. So you said you'd been in a bunch of relationships with people who had no ability to feel.
Yeah.
That cannot have been comfortable for you.
Very uncomfortable. And they were so uncomfortable with any feelings I had because it was alien to them.
Yep. And yet you repeated the pattern because I assume you'd been socialized by the people around you, by the culture in general,
yeah,
to choose those particular individuals.
Yes.
And you didn't feel fear when you went into it, not consciously. But think back, take the worst example. You don't have to name any names. Just think of the worst example. When was the first time in your relationship with this guy that something inside you went, oh, no, oh, no, 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 no. That's a tell. And you just sort of zoomed past it.
Pretty early on, but I needed somewhere to live. So I was willing to overlook that. Because I thought, well, I can deal with this because I don't have anywhere to live. And if I pay attention to this, then I have to leave and I won't have a bed to sleep in tonight.
Your fear was saying, okay, this guy is genuinely not perfect for me. Your intuition was turned off because you were basically saying, I'm going to pretend that everything's fine as a survival mechanism.
Yes. Survival overrode intuition in that case.
And right now, you're talking about it very clearly. But at the time, here's what the difference would have been. You would have said, I'm getting that vibe. He's one of those people. This is not a long-term solution for me. It will get me a place to sleep for a while, but I'm going to be very, very conscious that I'm going to stay in my own integrity and not lie to myself and know that this is a dangerous creature that I'm living with. And I will take suitable precautions and find a place to live other than him as soon as possible.
What I hear you saying is the most important part of this is don't dress it up for yourself.
100%.
You don't need to be telling the other person what is going on with you because that might not be safe. But for you, don't dress it up as being something that it isn't. Stay right. In integrity between you and you.
100%. Because there are going to be a majority of people around you who are not in integrity, and that will put you in varying degrees of risk. And if you're in total integrity, you see the risk very clearly. And that is actually what I think intuition is, the spider senses that say, oh, nope, but we ignore them and we override them. I always say this to rooms full of people. I'll stop in the middle of a speech and say, are you comfortable? Is everyone comfortable? And they're like, yeah. Really? Are you really comfortable? Yes. Keep talking.
No, they're not, because who's comfortable sitting in a crappy chair?
Precisely.
For the whole day?
Yeah. And I ask them, how many of you, if you were home alone right now, would be sitting in the position you're in right now? And no one raises a hand.
Yeah.
And then I say, why? And it takes them a long time to figure out, because I'm not comfortable. And
well, they're people pleasing. They don't want to be the person that's like, no, I'm really uncomfortable, because it might hurt your feelings.
Their brains are going through a filter that says, this is the way we sit, and this is polite, and this is how we gain knowledge and gather together. So given that, it's tolerable. That's really different from saying, No, actually, it's quite uncomfortable, but I'm willing to do it.
And I have to say that when you're around someone who speak up about every single thing, those people are tiring too. Where you're like, oh my God, you know, like you really have something to say about everything. Like, no, the food wasn't great. Yes, I'm uncomfortable. No, I don't like your driving. It's also like read the room and know when and how and who you're going to be sharing these things with.
Right. The thing that bothered me in that crowd and many others is not that they were uncomfortable. They were tolerably comfortable. It's the fact that they were lying to me and not knowing they were lying, even though they knew they were lying.
Right.
Does that make any sense?
Yes, that makes a lot of sense.
That's where we go off. And if you said instead, oh my gosh, this is so uncomfortable, but it's so worth it.
Yeah. So what do you think ultimately, living in integrity, what do you think the outcome of that choice over and over and over again gives us?
It means you're grounded in reality. It means that the math actually works. It's that when you go to do something, you're not deluding yourself and you're picking something that you enjoy. And what I always tell people is love sells better than hate. And if you end up doing things you love in places you love with people you love, and love is very marketable, it turns out. I mean, people will pay you for a Substack that gives them a lift every day, and it's worth it. And that's why I think the economy should be like an ecosystem. Instead of one person paying you $100,000, get 100,000 people who really feel well served giving you a dollar.
Maybe the book after the book you're now writing can be about that new financial paradigm, because I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, there are a lot of people working toward it, and maybe I just will. Thank you so much for the idea.
That's just me following the thread for you. Is there anything that we haven't spoken about that you would like to speak about?
There's one little maxim that I thought of that might be good to put in there somewhere, and that is this. Wherever you are, whatever you're thinking, the exact opposite of your worst fear right now is your next step toward freedom, is your best next step.
Wow, that is a beautiful Martha Beck quote. I'm going to take that one and make a social media asset out of it to let everyone know about this episode.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. It was a big joy to speak with you.
It was also a big joy for me.
Woo! Thank you. Thank
Win-win.
You.
Win-win. Thank you
really
so much.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to that fantastic episode. Please like, subscribe, and all that business. It does really help the podcast. And most importantly, come join me on Substack. Substack is where I'm showing the video of the entire episode that you just listened to. So find me on Substack if you want to dig in a bit deeper to the subjects that we talked about in this episode. See you there.